Rejoicing in Tribulation. A Christian man once said to a friend, "I do not believe that there is anyone in this city who feels richer than I do today." "Why?" the friend inquired. "What makes you feel that way?" "My feeling arises in connection with a financial difficulty," was the reply. "My rent has not been paid for the last 2 months." "I do not see how you can feel rich over that," said the surprised friend. "I should think that you would feel quite the contrary." "Yes," answered the man, "I supposed you would think so. I know that you have been worrying over the condition of your business affairs, and that is why I made this remark to you, with the purpose of explaining my reasons for feeling rich under the circumstances that I have named. Although I certainly would avoid debt when possible, and I am not ignoring the rights of the landlord, of which I shall speak later." Then the speaker went on talking, somewhat as follows. In the Scriptures, we are exhorted to become rich toward God, to lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven, and to seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. The Bible gives us to understand that the only true riches are spiritual riches, riches of consciousness, which are to be gained from God alone. All men are seeking what they call happiness, but few know in what it really consists or how to find it. Happiness can be nothing else than desirable states of consciousness. And the only desirable states of consciousness on which it is possible to gain a lasting hold are those which are based upon the realization of God and His manifestation in the mentalities of men. God is the only creator, the only power, the only governor, the only lawmaker. God is everywhere present, and according to His nature, is always manifest as love, joy, and peace. Hence, love, joy, and peace are the law of the universe, the law of being, the law of every man's mentality. When, therefore, a man realizes love, joy, and peace as proceeding from God, and as being based upon Him, rather than as proceeding from material things or human beings, he is truly living. But when a man entertains fear, doubt, grief, anxiety, foreboding, or any mental state contrary to love, joy, peace, and confidence in good, he is breaking the law of his being and is living a lie. That is, he really is not living at all, since false life is not life. There is no actual life which is not a manifestation of God, which does not express love, peace, and joy. Any other seeming life is only a counterfeit, an appearance which is not real. If we would really live, we must manifest or reflect God. Love, joy, and peace, which we think we have because of a hold upon certain material possessions, or because of relations socially agreeable, though non-spiritual, with certain people, are not the genuine article. They are counterfeit. They rest upon the wrong foundation. But love, joy, and peace, which we know to be based upon God, and which we hold because we are conscious of right relations with Him, these are the desirable states of consciousness which constitute the only true riches. Such riches are the pearl of great price, and to gain them, it is worth a man's while to part with everything else that he has, if necessary. It is the habit of most people to seek for love, joy, and peace from outward circumstances and from people, and not from God. Humanly speaking, men do not come naturally by spiritual riches any more than they come naturally by mathematics or a musical education. The true riches have to be laboriously gained, just as everything worth having in this human world has to be gained. Indeed, it is as unnatural for the carnal man to live in spiritual consciousness and thus to be spiritually rich, as it is for him to live in water. Men can learn to support themselves in water, and to live in water a considerable portion of the time. And likewise, they can learn to live in spirit a great deal of the time, and to enjoy themselves in spiritual life, independently, for the most part, of what is going on in matter or among people. The following illustration may help us to understand more clearly the process which we must go through in learning to live the spiritual life, and thus to be truly rich. Suppose a boy has set his heart upon learning to swim. He will do well to commence practicing in comparatively shallow water. For a time, he should remain where he can put his feet down and touch bottom at any time that he desires, without being over his head. But he will never be satisfied with himself as a swimmer until he has attained the ability to go out into deep water and remain there an hour at a time. He should not go into deep water too soon, but when he finds himself swimming in deep water, he does not lament, but rejoices. After remaining out of touch with the ground for a time, supported by the water only, he returns to land. But even while living on land, he can have the satisfaction of knowing that he is a swimmer worthy of the name. To remain such, he must, of course, spend considerable time in the water and keep in practice. A man who sets out to attain life in and of the Spirit cannot learn to support himself in spiritual consciousness all at once, any more than he can learn to swim all at once. He must begin by learning to depend on Spirit somewhat, a little more each week and month that passes, and to depend correspondingly less and less upon things and upon people for his happiness. Thus, as he grows spiritually, the time will come when he can maintain peace and joy in consciousness with practically no material means of support in sight. And when a person of any considerable length of experience in the Christian life finds himself in such a situation, instead of being anxious, grieved, or frightened about it, he should simply say to himself, "The material foundations for peace, joy, and confidence, on which I have been accustomed to depend, are now for the time being out of my reach. I am in the deep water of spirit. I wonder if, now, I cannot so depend upon Spirit God that I can maintain confidence, peace, and joy on the basis of my realizing the presence of spiritual good. A man of my religious experience should not look upon this present withdrawal of material support as a calamity, but should regard it as a testing time, by which I may ascertain how strong my confidence in God really is. And if I find that I can maintain my hold on joy with little or no material occasion for joy in sight, but with outward temptations to the contrary, I should rejoice in my present situation, as much as does the boy who has desired to learn to swim, when he finds himself swimming with confidence and success in deep water. A man can never really know whether he is a good swimmer or not, so long as his feet are on the bottom. Likewise, a man can never really know whether he is strong in spirit, if he has never been tried by having human and material foundations for confidence swept away from him. But after a man has been through such an experience, after he has been in deep water with God, and has found that he can maintain the life of peace and joy in spite of material lack, then he may return again to a condition of material plenty. But even when dwelling in the midst of material abundance, much as he did before, he does so with a different consciousness. He knows that he can live by the Spirit, if necessary, as he did not know before. He can say with St. Paul, "I have learned both how to abound and how to suffer lack." In the spiritual growth of each one of us, it seems almost necessary that, at some time, we shall be put through a testing time. And usually, the testing time comes. If we measure up to the test, if instead of whining, lamenting, and being afraid, we fall back on our knowledge and realization of God and His manifestations, and determine to be happy anyway, even more so because the time for us to be worthy to be tested has arrived, then it invariably happens that before very long, the usual supply of human comforts are restored to us. But if we do not prove that we can live in peace and joy alone with God, we will be forced to endure a continuance of material lack, or recurring experiences of it, until we do learn the spiritual lesson of being happy in spiritual possessions only. There seems to be no way of escaping such a testing time. And it is probably essential to our spiritual growth that there should be no way of escape until we have learned the requisite lesson. Thus, may we learn the meaning of St. Paul's experience of rejoicing in tribulation. It is from a standpoint of realization such as this, to a large extent, that the withdrawal of one's material means of supply can be to him a distinct occasion for feeling rich, rich in the realization of spiritual good, which constitutes the only true riches. But the question may be raised, how about the landlord from whom the rent was being withheld? Suppose that he might be needing it. What is to be said from his point of view? The reply is that, of course, his tenant should pay the rent, if he could, and without doubt would do so. If he could not, it would not help the situation in the least for him to worry, fret, or be afraid. If anything, for him to lapse into such a state of mind would becloud his intelligence, sap his strength, and thus tend to prevent his gaining the means to pay the rent. But does God provide a testing time for the real spiritual advantage of one of His children at the expense of what seems like the just due of another? No, God is no respecter of persons. God is light, and in Him is no darkness at all. God creates only absolute good, and dwells in the consciousness of nothing but absolute good. He is immortal, and does not create his opposite. He neither creates nor orders material affairs. Men are in darkness, and only reach light as they work their way into a consciousness of God. The natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are spiritually discerned. If a landlord has sufficiently learned his spiritual lesson respecting the working out of humanity's problem, he will not be the one at whose seeming expense the spiritual growth of another will be promoted. But if he has not learned to live in the Spirit and walk in the Spirit, then he also needs the experience of being made to suffer material lack until he too wakes up and learns his spiritual lesson. Let us try to describe, at its best, the life which is merely or mostly human. A boy is born and reared in a good family. He goes to school and college and is diligent and studious. He keeps the moral law and lives above reproach among his fellow men. He marries a girl of excellent family, education, character, and refinement. They have children who are the admiration of all who know them. Before marrying, the man started in business. He was and is intelligent and capable. From the start, he makes a good living. His debts are always paid on the day they are due. He has a reputation to be proud of in the business world, and is proud of it. Men say of him, "His word is as good as his bond." He can borrow a reasonable amount of money at any bank because he is known to be successful and honest and to have accumulated some resources. He and the members of his family attend church regularly as a matter of course and support the church liberally. They all move in the most intelligent and refined social circles. Now, all of this may be, and sometimes is, what St. John disapprovingly speaks of as the pride of life in the following text. "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. For if any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, are not of the Father, but of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever." The man whom we have described would doubtless think of himself, if asked about it, as a godly man. But he has never closely analyzed his own thought. As a matter of fact, so far as he thinks about it at all, he has an implicit sense that he is good, that he is honest and upright, that he is diligent and intelligent, that he has made a business and social position for himself, that he has accumulated property and made a place in the world, that he is secure in the good place which he has made. If so, his sense of security, peace, and joy all rest on a false material and human foundation, which very likely may have to be swept from under his feet in order that he may wake up to what is the true foundation for security and joy, namely, the knowledge of Spirit, God, and not material goods and the good opinion of men. The man has not yet learned the significance of the words of Jesus. "Why callest thou me good? There is none good save one, that is God." He has not yet taken to heart the scripture which says, "Trust in the Lord with all thy heart, and lean not to thine own understanding, but in all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. But after such a man has successfully experienced his testing time, and fortunate is he who promptly recognizes the opportunity for a test and its significance when it comes, and has proved that he can live in joy without any special amount of worldly goods or human approval, then, very likely, all the outward possessions that he had before will be given back to him in multiplied measure. But let him beware of again allowing his heart to trust in his material riches. Let him continue to be diligent to lay up treasures in heaven, in spiritual consciousness, where moth and rust do not corrupt, and where thieves do not break through and steal. Evil hath no origin. God, the infinite good, created all that is, and good never created its opposite any more than light could create darkness. Therefore, evil is not created and does not belong to reality. It is an appearance without foundation in fact, therefore an illusion, therefore no thing, nothing. When did truth become a lie? The answer is, truth did not become a lie. When did evil, illusion, nothing begin? The answer is, evil, no thing, nothing, did not begin. Philosophizing about the origin of nothing has consumed such an amount of time and effort that, had they been spent in contemplation of the truth which heals, much more of health and good would have been demonstrated. All sins and evils are mistakes. God never makes mistakes. Hence, mortal mind makes its own mistakes, and God is not the author of sin or evil.